This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848, or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Ed Tilton, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Tom Gentry, thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. This episode features a conversation with a guy named Ed Tilton, who is a recovery advocate in the Denver, Colorado area. I encountered Ed in late 2019. There's someone who I care about in that area who needed some help. And long story short, there was an agency out there I'd done some work with, and Ed is a key member of the team there. So although I hadn't met him before during this, situation with my loved one, he and I ended up having a number of conversations, which I enjoyed. And pretty quickly, we became good friends. It became apparent that we see eye to eye on a lot of things, and notably, issues around manhood. Done a lot of the same kind of reading, just philosophically aligned. And if you've listened to this podcast, you know that that's something that's really important to me. It's the lens through which I've been looking at myself for many years. It's men's work, men's issues, definitely influences the work I do in my day-to-day life. And to find somebody who kind of just sees things the way that I do, and doesn't just kind of space out when I kind of, I get really passionate about this stuff, and I'll get to talking, and then, you know, sometimes they're just not into it. But it's been great to find someone who is into this the same way that I am. And I knew really quickly that I wanted to do something with Ed, and I made that clear to him. And once I put that out into the world, I mean, I realized more and more it was just the right thing. And he was definitely someone with whom I wanted to collaborate. So I've been trying to get him on this podcast for quite a bit now. And finally did. Recorded this, I don't know, about a month ago. And since then, both of us were really happy with how this conversation went. Not only did we enjoy it, but I just like where the conversation kind of meandered. And so we were both really into it. And I think that kind of led us down this path of creating a series of podcasts about manhood. And so we've made a decision to collaborate. He's going to co-host a series of episodes that, at least in the beginning, we're going to do monthly. and it's called Getting Real About Manhood. And we're calling it that because I don't think we are very real about manhood. We have all these, you know, ideas about what men should look like that are kind of spoon-fed to us through popular culture. We have these archetypes that don't necessarily fit in the world anymore. And, you know, I think the reality thing, the getting real thing, I feel like something that's been hard for me and I think is hard for a lot of men and they don't even acknowledge it is that we're not grounded in reality in the sense that by and large, men aren't attached or connected to their emotions. And I think that's a big problem. And I've seen a lot of people suffer because of that over the years. And I just think it really has us off course in a lot of ways as a society. I think we numb ourselves, both genders. A lot of us numb ourselves from reality, painful truths in life, our existential wounds. But I think men do it more. So really excited about starting this new series. I think the first episode is going to come out on May 22nd. And just couldn't have found a better person to do this with than Ed. I love him. He's a great guy. I'm just really grateful that he and I have crossed paths and really excited about this project, and I hope you are too. So this is an opportunity for you all to get to know Ed a little bit, and you're going to be hearing a lot more from him. So enjoy, Ed Tilton.
Just the product of some bad seeds.
Ed, how you doing?
Doing well. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to have you on the podcast here. It's a long time coming.
Yeah. It's
something we've been threatening to do for a little while now.
This is true.
Yeah. So thanks for taking the time to do this. I know you're a busy guy.
Absolutely.
So why don't you tell the world what it is that you do with your time?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess in the simplest form, I just work on the front lines of addiction, working to battle the disease and help those that are still suffering find and create a life worth living. And I do that from a number of different perspectives. On a 9-to-5 kind of deal, I'm a program director here at a local treatment center here in Denver, Colorado. And then I've also devoted some service positions to be on a nonprofit organization for a recovery community out in Evergreen, Colorado called Sparrow. And then also just being of service to anybody who calls me to help them kind of find the next place or space where they can find recovery. So it's a full-time job. It's a full-time job for sure.
So do you want to talk a little bit about what led you to that and what you were doing before?
Oh yeah. It's a fun and wild ride. growing up, I grew up in a very small remote town in Illinois, and population 75 people. And it was kind of one of those things where you know everybody and everybody knows you. And, you know, growing up for me, that wasn't always like a great thing. Cause I could be a little bit of a handful, but I always like to say Illinois is like a great place to grow up, but it's not a great place to live. So you know, I started making moves pretty early on, you know, to get out of my small little town. So, you know, as soon as I was able to get to high school, I was fortunate enough. I got a soccer scholarship to play at a private Catholic school that was about 40 minutes away. And so, so I went over, you know, to that school and really got like a first hand education or first class education on just kind of, the do's and don'ts of the world. There was a lot of substance use, a lot of partying. And I knew it's interesting. Like I knew at that point, that I was not like one of the privileged or elite, families.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there was two, you know, I was the kid that was bussed in. I was the kid that, you know, I was the kid that was on soccer scholarship. And, you know, I was able to watch a lot of these, very privileged, kids, you know, they would do cocaine and they would drink and they would do all this stuff. And we were actually the only school to have drug testing, in the whole city of like Bloomington Normal, Illinois. And they actually were doing hair follicle tests, but it was kind of always interesting. You know, there were certain kids that they got tested at the beginning of the year and then they never got tested again.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then there was, you know, Ed Tilton that got tested 7 times. Right. and so I kind of knew that this was, you know, something to stay away from. So I actually devoted all of my high school career, to not drinking or drugging. And then, you know, I suffered a knee injury, my junior year of high school. Going into my senior year, and I lost all my soccer scholarships or prospective scholarships, and ended up going to state school. So I went to Southern Illinois University, and it was one of those, you know, moments that you'll never kind of forget. Like I didn't really fully grasp the depression that I was like sliding into after losing scholarships, and I wasn't ever like a great student, so I barely made it into Southern Illinois University, only with the help of Father Hennehan. He wrote me this like a character reference letter, I showed up pretty depressed to Southern Illinois. But you know, depression looks a lot of different ways, and so for me, depression wasn't you know, I couldn't get out of bed, but depression was really just not really knowing where I fit in the world and not really understanding like what I was doing, you know, with my own purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember I was walking down Cherry Street in Carbondale, Illinois, and this is pre like social media, Facebook stuff. And, they used to like write all the, parties on the sidewalk, you know, when they would like, and I have no idea how the cops never found us. But it was a bizarre system. And there was this sidewalk chalk that said, "Are you looking for brotherhood? You know, come to this party." And it was like, you know, I think we kind of look for God in weird ways. And I think, you know, I was looking for a higher power, something to save me. And so I went to this house. I went to this party, and there was as much drinking and as much drugging as you wanted to do, you know. And I think most people probably would have, you know, said, "This doesn't look like a good idea." And you know, for me, it was like I found my people. You know, and I remember, you know, that night just feeling like this warm blanket had like come over me and was just like supporting me. And then I had all these guys that wanted to hang out with me the next day. you know, and they invited me to things, and I was like part of the group, and, you know, and I was athletic still, and they talked about like intramural sports, and we do all these things, and, you know, and that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to just kind of have a party on tap, so to speak. And, I spent the next 4 years just like incubating what I later found out was a full blown addiction. And, you know, there are like indications that I wish like I would have seen beforehand. And, I had a couple professors, you know, that said some things to me. But I don't think I was ready to hear them. And, you know, you could ask me 100 times and I still couldn't give you an answer of like how I was able to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly I think it was because we had this room in our fraternity, that you could basically, it was every test that was ever taken. Like one of the guys would swipe it and they'd put it in this like cabinet. You know, and so I had a lot of like past tests to, you know, I'm using air quotes here, but to review off of or whatever.
Right.
In Southern Illinois, don't take my degree, please. You know, and so I managed to get a degree, and, you know, I thought that I was going to kind of just change my life. I thought, you know, I was just going to shelf all the partying and all the stuff that I did and just kind of move on. And, I moved, you know, 1,000 miles away to Denver, Colorado. And I thought, you know, if I change people, places and things, then everything will change. And, you know, what I like to say now is, you know, I left college, but college didn't want to leave me.
Hmm.
And, I found out like pretty quickly that, you know, you can, like, college really gets in the way of like drinking and drugging, like, you know, having a job or having like an employment opportunity. I wouldn't even call it like a job, because it's just, you're just barely functioning. But it makes it a lot easier to kind of grow that addiction, and your world gets real small real quick. And, you know, but it wasn't, you know, I guess one of the things that I would say to anybody who's listening is, I was so wrapped up in this idea that it was a quantity thing, you know, that it was, if I was, you know, drinking every day, or if I was drinking so much every day, or, and I would play these games in my head all the time of like, well, you know, I had like 6 beers today and I had like 12 beers yesterday, so I'm not that bad and I don't have a problem. And, you know, it took me a long time to realize that it's less about quantity and it's more about quality. You know, my quality of life just wasn't what I deserved or what I was capable of. And, you know, unfortunately, I had, along the way, convinced my girlfriend at the time to marry me. And she was under the understanding that, you know, she knew me in college, and she kind of knew that person that I was. And she was kind of really rooting for me to, you know, to change my life. And I just couldn't do it. And so, you know, I think that there are these things where real eye openers and things that really scare you into seeing something differently. And when you have somebody who's choosing to love you and you can't love them back because you love something more. And you know, for me, that was alcohol. That was some of the scariest moments of my life, mm-hmm. You know, cause I couldn't, once I started, I could not stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew like where it was going to take me. And so, you know, our anniversary is 5/7/11. And so in the first year of marriage, I was able to successfully ruin, all of it. And on 5/8/12, she kicked me out. You know, I had decided or thought it was a good idea to have to bring tequila into the house on 5/7/12. And, you know, like I said before, once I started drinking, I never knew where it was going to take me. And so this time it took me out of the house. And so, you know, it was kind of one of those things. You know, sometimes you're looking for your higher power and sometimes your higher power finds you. And so on that morning, my uncle had called me, and for those that, you know, have struggled with active addiction, you kind of know what I'm talking about, which is, you know, my family narrative had kind of gone from Ed's having fun in college, Ed's having too much fun in college, Ed has a problem. And then, you know, anytime the family would talk about me, it was always like, well, we're hoping the best for Ed. You know, we really hope he's doing okay. And so, you know, my mom would send out these emails of like, you know, asking relatives to call and things like that. And I'd get random phone calls from, you know, aunts and stuff asking how I was doing. And I knew it was my mom because, you know, she never gave up on me. And, you know, so this particular day, my uncle called me and he asked me how I was doing. And I said, you know, I said I was good. Which is just the baffling part of this disease. And, you know, I blame like all the action movies of like, as a man, I always believe that like when faced with like adversity, when faced with like an opportunity, to rise to the occasion and tell the truth and do the next right thing, that I would. And the reality is I never did. You know, in my addiction, when faced with honesty, I would lie, you know? So I told my uncle, oh, I'm doing fine. And he says, well, it sounds like you've been drinking. And I said, no, you just woke me up. And, you know, and he said, well, I'm real worried about you. And, you know, it was the first time in a while that somebody had actually said that they were worried. Or it was maybe the first time that I'd heard it in a while. And it broke me. You know, and I told him what was going on, and I told him that I thought I needed help. And, you know, and he says, absolutely, you know, come on up here. And he was living up by Boulder at the time. And I said, okay, like, yeah, let's do that. And he says, well, here's the deal. If you come up here, you can't drink. And so again, when faced with adversity, you know, I did the worst thing. So I hung up on him, you know, and he called me back, cause my uncle's he's a sweet man. And he's a little bit of he's an interesting guy. You know, I always describe him of if the character House and the other character, from the Big Bang Theory, kind of Sheldon had like a love child, that would be my uncle. Like he has like an emotional Teflon. Like he just called back and was like, I think we got disconnected. And in my mind, I'm just like, no, I hung up on you. and you know, and so he says, well, I really want you to get help and I want to help you. And so, you know, I agreed. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I'm one of the lucky few, that got to go to treatment. And, you know, I was lucky that I still had family support. And, you know, my experience in treatment was, you know, it was good. But my disease was strong and I lied for about the first month of treatment. You know, I did everything that you shouldn't do. I told them everything's fine. Everything's good. And, then they just kept me in treatment for a long time. And, you know, my uncle, he's a medical professional, and he says, you know, there's a thing, there's an ethics board, in the medical world. And he says, I think you need like a ethics committee just cause you're too smart for your own good and you make dumb choices is what he told me. And he says, you know, if you want to start making different changes in your life, you got to have, you know, no less than five people on this committee. He had to be one of them, and there were rules, right? And so how it would work is if I wanted to change any part of my living environment or my daily interactions or so, I had to talk to the committee. And he says, you know, the rules were, it had to be a yes, no question. It had to be 10 words or less, because I'm a bit of a wordsmith. So if you give me too long, with you, I can kind of convince you that it's a good idea, or I'll just wear you down.
Right.
And so, you know, I'd call him up and I'd call up the committee and, you know, I think I stacked like, I think it was like four guys from treatment. Cause I was like, well, these guys, they'll like sign off on my stuff. And, you know, thank God they didn't, because I'd say, hey, you know, I think it's time for me to go home. And they'd go, no, you know, and then I would have to, you know, sit with that discomfort, you know. It was super important for me to get like immediate feedback. It was super important for me to like sit with a no without realizing that like that wasn't like a failure in life. It was just like it was just a no. And so, so I lived out of the house for 9 months, and I finally, I didn't realize this, and this is, I didn't realize it till it happened, but this is how sneaky the disease is. I had decided, I had one like last reservation, and the reservation was that, at 9 months I was going to go, or I got back in to the house with my wife, and I thought, well, I'm going to go buy her a thing of champagne, and I'm going to celebrate that I'm back in the house. And my plan was, you know, that I was going to tell her is that I wasn't going to drink it, but it was, you know, once again, this like macho dumb stuff that some we can do. And my goal was to sit it down and say, here you go, have a glass of champagne. I'm so happy to be home. And by the way, I don't even want to drink it. You know, it takes most people a lifetime to beat addiction, but I did it in 9 months, you know, and when I processed all of this later with my therapist and everything, I was able to get real honest. And my sneaky plan was, my wife has never finished like any alcoholic beverage like in her life. You know, she leaves, you know, half a glass of wine or whatever the case was up, you know, when she was drinking at that point. And my plan was that she was going to go ahead and not finish any of it. And she's going to put it in the fridge, and then she would go to bed at like 9 o'clock. And then I would be able to have just one glass of champagne, to test myself just one more time to see if I really, had the disease or not. And for whatever reason, one of the things that really stuck with me in treatment was this idea of like playing the tape forward, you know, and I had another like moment of clarity where I realized like, she's not going to be excited if I bring alcohol into the house, and she's not going to accept it, and I'm going to be homeless again or living with my uncle. And so, you know, I remember the feeling of my hands on the steering wheel. I remember also not really understanding like why I was even like at the liquor store. I remember the thoughts of like how, what I was going to do. But I don't ever remember like driving to the liquor store. And so I was totally freaked out, and I called a buddy. I went to a meeting, you know, and at that point I was 100% in.
So, you know, let me clarify. So did you buy the champagne?
No.
Okay. But no. But you drove to the liquor store.
I fantasized the whole thing. Okay. You know, I'd kind of played all of it out, and I'd driven to the liquor store, and, you know, the car was still running, and that was kind of when it happened, of like actually thinking things through. So, you know, and then I started kind of the long journey of marriage therapy with my wife, because I had loved her the most and I had traumatized her the most. And I had a lot of work to do after the work that I thought I had already done. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was fortunate enough, through a lot of work on my part and through a lot of grace and love on my wife's part, and work on hers as well, that we saved the marriage. And so, you know, I'm happy to report that we're still married. We have two kids, a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, or soon to be 1-year-old. And, you know, all the things that I never thought were possible, all the things that I had kind of written off to be somebody else's life, are now mine. You know, I own a home just right outside Denver. I pay taxes on time, or like with extensions, but like close to on time. And, you know, I'm a productive member of society. You know, and I work in a field where, you know, I'm excited to go to work every day. I'm excited to see the miracle happen in other people. And so, you know, in between now and then, you know, I had the great opportunity to work for the state of Colorado, and I helped develop a lot of our recovery courts and our family recovery courts. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things where I just wanted to be of service, but I didn't want to be, you know, kind of on the front lines, so to speak. So I wrote federal grants for the state of Colorado, and I really tried to help in that aspect. And then, you know, I kept getting these opportunities, you know, through my, what I believe is like through my creator, to, you know, go back to school and understand more about addiction and, you know, get credentials to be able to work as a counselor in addiction. And then ultimately, you know, back in 2015, everything kind of changed for me. My boss at the time, was let go, and for some pretty interesting reasons, and I'll have to tell you about that another time. But I was fortunate enough to have some really close mentors and people that loved and cared about me, and they kind of showed me the ways of, you know, of counseling and you know, consulting and kind of like working in the addiction industry and the recovery, you know, oriented professions. And through there, I just kind of did the next right thing, met the next right person, and, you know, was able to fall, into my current position here at Valiant Living, and where we work with men over the age of 30, rebuild their lives. And to be quite honest, it's a lot of like what I needed. You know, it's a lot of, I remember being, you know, I remember being in a room full of like 20, like early 20 somethings, that were, you know, all really focused on, you know, getting their car keys back and, you know, all the things that early 20 something year olds do. And I was terrified because I was facing facing losing my marriage, and, you know, I was 1,000 miles away from, you know, my family back home in Illinois. And so what we really wanted to create was a space and a place, for men who were a little bit older in their life that kind of needed that love and support, and, a 90-day program that really helped, build that life for them. And so, you know, I have like the coolest job in the world. You know, because we're able to kind of like see the, you know, the miracle, the transformation. And we're also able to like the beauty of like doing the work that you and I do is I get to sit with people when they think that everything's over, and I know that it's not. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I, one of the things that I've like come to understand is that trust is not about like the here and now, but trust is about like the future. You know, I trust the process. I trust the promises. I trust the fact that like, if you can stick with me, you're going to come out okay. And that in this process, we're going to introduce you to, you know, a brotherhood, a community, a family of choice that really sees you for who you want to be, and who you are developing into. So it's an amazing life.
Hmm. So how do you, just to tie into the theme of the podcast, how do you see this story of yours tying into the concept of personal authenticity?
It's a great question. You know, in the development of my recovery and kind of the solidifying all that personal growth piece, I've been able to amass these men who truly loved me, and push me and help me see a more authentic side, you know, because it's so easy to just slip back into autopilot or a less authentic version of ourselves. And, you know, and I've got these amazing men in my life and my wife as well, who call me on my stuff, mm-hmm. you know, who push me to be, who push me to be the person that I want to be for not only like myself, but for my children, for the other men in the program, and really like through modeling. And, you know, it's not always easy, but it's always worth it, you know, and that's, you had a guest on recently, and I think it was Jana Angel, and she had said something to the effect of, you know, that I just need to be the best version of myself, that I am right now, you know, not perfection, but just as I'm showing up today, how can I be the best version right now? Hmm. And that really stuck with me. And I think that's a practice, you know, without necessarily naming it, that's what I've been really working on over the last, you know, almost 8 years now.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting to me, you told the story about the message on the sidewalk that led you to that group of guys. If you're looking for brotherhood.
Oh yeah.
And for me, my drinking, the word that popped into my head when you said that was connection. Mm. Because in hindsight, what I know is that what I was really looking for was connection where I didn't have it. And I thought because people I loved drank and, you know, I could be a part of something they were a part of if I did it. You know, that's really what I was looking for. It wasn't about a buzz. It wasn't about changing the way that I felt in that sense. It was about feeling connected. And
you're so right.
And it gave me that for a little while.
Oh, yeah.
Really, like my senior year in high school is what comes to mind. Because it was, at that point, it was like a social thing. There was a lot of fun involved. But then kind of after that, it just, you know, really, I started, using it as the tool to change the way I felt. But the irony in all that is that where I found connection was when I stopped drinking.
Oh, for sure.
When I got into recovery and I began having deep and meaningful relationships with mostly men who had been clean and sober for a long time. And in the beginning, even people who weren't in the treatment experience, but you know, I learned that, you know, there was a side of life and a depth and connection with people that I always craved, but I never had. And if I hadn't experienced the, you know, pain of addiction, mm-hmm. I might have never found it.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're so right. Because I was looking for connection. Like I was missing my teammates, you know, that like connection that you build through sport. And, you know, when I found those guys, when I found my fraternity, you know, we would just do absurd things and we would think that it was like connection. Mm-hmm. And it was the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just numbing.
Yeah.
You know, but they gave me cool nicknames until I thought like my nickname in the fraternity was Moose, you know, and after a couple of drinks, you know, they'd all yell, "The moose is loose." And I thought that was just so cool. And the reality is like, nobody would remember anything that we did the night before.
Right.
You know, and now like one of the things that, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that I struggle with it, but I've definitely become more selective with it is if, unless we're having like unless there's that connection, like I'm probably going to go spend my time elsewhere, you know, just because like to what you said, once you kind of understand what like real intimacy looks like, you know, it's hard to talk about Peyton Manning stats. You right. know, it's hard to talk right. about like, you know, do I think the Blackhawks are going to win, you know, this year, or, you know, and any of the other stuff. And, you know, I can play along to a degree, but, it's also just, it's like, well, if this is leading somewhere cool, like let's get to it. Cause we've got such a amazing world that we live in. And the beautiful thing about like living in a life of recovery is I get to remember all of it and I get to experience every bit of it, which isn't always like wildly exciting, you know, or, you know, fun, but I recently started doing this thing, which I think is kind of cool, but I started a journal, which I call the Delight Journal. And so every day, at the end of my day, I write down like, what are some of the little pieces that brought me delight that day? You know, and part of it came about because I was doing one of like my many gratitude lists. And I was thinking I should really start to like capture these moments of when, you know, gratitude meets opportunity and kind of like brings delight, when I'm grateful about something in the moment that brings me happiness. And, because they're so quick. And they leave so fast, you know, and I've got now, I mean, I've got all these, you know, pages and pages, of little stories, you know, mostly of my children, you know, but like last night, one of them was my daughter, she wanted to have family movie night, you know, and she wanted to have everybody in their pajamas. And so she went out and picked out my pajamas and she made me put them on, and same for my wife and same for, you know, baby Clay and everybody, you know, she wanted to cuddle up as a family. And the delight for me is that had I not experienced the miracle, had I not, you know, worked the program, believed in something bigger than myself, you know, surrendered a lot of like my own stuff and will, she may never be in this world.
Right.
And if she was, she wouldn't want to spend time with me.
Right.
She'd be terrified of me. My wife wouldn't want to spend time with, you know, and it's just like all of these moments kind of culminated to this 1 5-second piece of delight where she looks at me and says, "Daddy, I want you to get your PJs on so we can watch movies together."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, in terms of like the authentic piece, that's a culmination of all my brothers pushing me to be the best version of myself, and me to really trust a process so that when she looks at me and says, "Daddy, I want to do this. I'm not on my phone. I'm not drunk. I'm not doing something I shouldn't be doing." And I can look her in the eye and say, "Absolutely, you go pick out my jammies." And that means everything to me.
Hmm. What movie did you watch?
Well, she's five, so, you know, I think it was some strawberry cupcake of sorts, you know, so she picked it at like 7 o'clock and she's like, "Let's watch a movie." And we're like, "Cool, we'll watch one of the 30-minute movies," which, you know, are just like TV shows. 'Cause it's like, you know, I'm trying to be authentic, but I'm also trying to be a good parent. So, right. You know, you got to get to bed by like 7:38. But yeah, she's everything.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, well, it is. It is. You know.
So, this has been a great conversation. Let's talk about, you know, you and I connected over a case.
Yeah.
For me, it just has been this really pleasant surprise to meet someone who I feel like we kind of see things the same way. You know, 'cause the kind of stuff that you're talking about, being in the moment, appreciating something, identifying it, owning it, just, that's like the real carpe diem concept.
For sure.
Where, you know, when I was drinking, I thought it was, you know, let's seize the day and party. You know, when really that's not living, that's dying, you know? But that, right, that to me, that whole thing is just another example of how you and I just, you know, connect. And, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot is what it means to be a man. You know, just a lot of the beliefs that culturally we have about what it means to be a man, and how off track we are as a culture with that. And talk about that a little bit, about how that has fit into your journey of recovery and change and self-improvement.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you and I, you know, we do share like so much of, you know, I think kind of, you grew up in Indiana and I grew up in Illinois, and neither one of us grew up in you know, meccas of industry or, you know, excitement. I could be wrong about Kokomo, but I think it's
there's actually
similar.
A lot of industry. I mean, it is a factory town, but it's the excitement isn't, it definitely not there, you know?
Yeah. And so, my first understanding of what it was, you know, to be a man was a lot of, you know, that you don't cry, you don't ask for help. Unless it's something related to like dude stuff, like, mm-hmm. you know, it's okay to call your neighbor to get out of the, you know, like growing up in the country, if you like slid off the road mm-hmm. into the ditch, like it's okay to call your neighbor, but only after you've like winched up the truck and, you know, tried five or six times and it's, you know, you need extra help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was big into, you know, men are strong, and, you know, for me, I got a lot of like the imagery and the message of physical strength, you know? And so I did a lot of like weightlifting, and I did a lot of, you know, I never got into the bodybuilding, thank goodness, but, you know, I did a lot of the, you know, you got to be bigger than other people. You got to dominate other people. And I did that a lot through sport. But, you know, and unfortunately, like my messaging, around women was just so unhealthy. You know, it was a lot of, you gotta have like the prettiest girl and that's not even enough. Like I was not a great guy in high school, you know, and it was, you know, I think at one point, well, not I think, I know at one point I was dating the captain of the cheerleading team or squad. I think they call them squads. And I was also talking to other girls,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it wasn't enough to even like, you know, and there's this idea or this messaging that I got of like, people should be like lucky to be with you. But the problem was because I had cultivated all this messaging around, don't ask for help. Don't talk about stuff going on at home. Don't talk about your emotions. Don't any of that stuff. All of it was just external.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would play like I wanted people to want me. And the reality is like, I didn't even want to be me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't. And so, you know, when it came to getting into a room full of guys talking about their feelings, talking about, you know, surrendering, like that was the weirdest idea for me. This idea that you got to surrender to win was, I mean, it went against everything that I was told.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I did a really good job of half surrendering. Like I'd be like, well, I'll surrender kind of like this idea,
right.
but this other piece, I need to keep, you know, that's going to keep me safe. Until I finally just had to realize that the whole idea of what I thought was healthy was unhealthy. That I needed a group conscience to help me understand what was best for the group, what was best for the community. And ultimately what's best for the community is probably what's best for me. You know, that my ideas aren't helping anybody, because they're rooted in my sickness. You know, and that's been able to change, in terms of like me being able to help people over the years, but I remember, you know, doing work with other guys in the program, and, you know, my sponsor at the time would always have to say, you know, because he knew like there was just more truth. He just had to keep saying and then I would get more and more and more honest. But let me tell you, it was, I had a belief for a long time that all of this was just going to result in public humiliation or shaming. I thought if I tell all my secrets, if I tell all the stuff that's going on in my head, like people are going to stop hanging out with me. People are stop going to call, like they're not going to call me. And it was the most surreal experience where the more I got honest and the more I shared, the more people would work with me, the more people wanted to help me, and the more people thought that I could help them.
That, you know, that connected. That was a big revelation to me because, you know, I remember really, really clearly the first time ever really telling my story and telling all of it. I mean, my story of addiction.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some parts of it that I was ashamed of.
Oh yeah.
Like my, the habit I developed of drinking Listerine comes to mind. Like normal people don't do shit like that. Like that's an alcoholic thing to do. And it was, I mean, that I was really ashamed of that, but yeah. And I'm this 23-year-old kid. And so, but I had been through enough to know that I can't hold back.
Right.
I got to let it all hang out. And so, you know, got into treatment, into detox at like 12:30 in the morning on a Saturday. By Sunday night, they're moving me over to the residential unit and the peer leader comes to me and he's like, hey, if you want to tell your story tonight, you can. And there was a part of me that got scared, but I pushed myself and said, yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it.
Oh, wow.
And I told him, you know, by this time, I'm not even 24 hours off an airplane. and like, so I just, blah, just like, and it was the peer group. There were no staff involved. It was just peers.
Oh my God.
And I told them all my story and they were like, wow. You know, I told them about the pot smoking that I wasn't talking about before. I told them about the Listerine stuff. I told them about, you know, a lot of my drinking career came from, you know, getting into my dad's liquor cabinet, even after I was legally, you know, able to buy alcohol and all those things that I thought were going to like, really, I was going to be shunned for.
Mm-hmm.
What I learned is bringing that kind of honesty and vulnerability is what made them accept me. It's for what made me endear myself to them. And, you know, so it was a clear lesson that I got is, you know, those, I think if I'm honest with people, they're going to, you know, they're going to reject me. But what really happens when you do that, when you really show up and you're really real with people is that they accept you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, and I remember being surprised. You know, I had written all these, you know, what I kind of called like bottom line behaviors, like down in my head somewhere of like, I'm not going to steal. I'm not going to cheat on people. I'm not going to, you know, like lie or put people in danger or whatever it was. And then, you know, in my addiction, I was so surprised how easy it was to justify those behaviors. And then to how hard it was to talk about them later. Right. You know, when it came time to really get honest and to get everything out on the table, you know, to your point, it was like how much I did not want to. I really thought like, okay, if I tell you this one, you're going to know I'm a creep.
Right.
You're going to know that I'm weird. And you're right. It had the reverse effect. And so, you know, kind of the culmination to all of this for me is now I have, you know, a 1-year-old son And I get to be, I have an opportunity, is what I'll say, to help him at least have a safe place to learn, you know, and to experience kind of the counter argument or the counter narrative to what it means to be a man,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I'm not, you know, I'm not misguided on the fact that the world's going to teach him about trucks and, you know, stomping around and, you know, shooting stuff or, well, I mean, that's more my countryside. But anyway, and some of those things aren't inherently bad.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think you can, you know, work a backhoe and do manual labor and spit. And that doesn't mean that you're a bad person, but I think the pieces for me of denying like the real authentic self, the part of you that only you understand to be true.
Mm-hmm.
That's the part where, you know, we start to develop, you know, toxic patterns and behaviors in our relationships. And, you know, my hope for, you know, for baby Clay is that he can always come to me and he can always start to learn those behaviors of like what it's like to surrender,
mm-hmm.
you know, a thought that's bothering you to somebody else, or what it's like to be able to ask for help and to cry without feeling like people are going to make fun of you.
Well, and I have a 13-year-old son, so I can completely relate to what you're talking about. And I've had the same opportunity. And this, you know, this is a concept that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I want you and I to have a whole separate conversation about this. But, you know, one of the things that I've taught my son over the years, you know, in recovery, we learn about our boundaries and we learn about, well, at least I was taught that not everybody in my life deserves to be in a place of trust, and I get to right. choose who are the people who get to be close to me, who get to be intimate with me. And that should depend on how they treat me.
Right.
And whether they're trustworthy. And so, you know, I'm pretty open about the way I feel and stuff. And I've taught my son the same thing. But at a certain point, he is emotionally literate, as probably as much as a 13-year-old could be. And I could probably say that about him at every age, not only because I'm who I am and do what I do, but his mom is a therapist too. So, you know, he just lives in it.
Yeah.
But at some point, you know, when, like I remember when he was really little, you know, us talking about something, I hurt his feelings or something. And I remember it may not even have been me. It may have been somebody else in our circle at the time, but I remember him saying, "I forgive you, but it's not okay." And to like have a little kid say that, I mean, wow, like that's so healthy. But you know, then at some point when you're in school, you know, and talking to him about what's happening at school and how he feels, and I've also been able to teach him, listen, it's good to talk about how you feel, but it's also not safe to talk to just anyone about how you feel. And like the other kids who are around you, they're not going to be taught to talk about how to feel and to talk about their feelings the way that you have. So what's important is to talk to people who you trust about that stuff, to talk to your mom and dad about that stuff, to talk to your closest friends about that stuff, and not to just talk to anybody about it. And bigger picture, to me, that concept, you blow that up and you know, we live in this world of men who, and I'm not excluding myself from this, you know, we are by and large desensitized, and we have desensitized ourselves to our emotions, right?
Yeah.
We don't talk about how we feel. We don't think about how we feel. We try to pretend that we don't feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what has probably happened is that safety that has to exist, you know, it's probably on an instinctive level, like, okay, the saber-toothed tiger is chasing me down right now. It's probably not a good time to experience fear.
Right.
It's probably the best thing to do right now is to compartmentalize that and run for my fucking life. You know what I mean? Survive.
Right.
Right. And then when I'm out of peril, holy shit, that was scary. Right.
Right.
So compartmentalize. And instead what that has become is don't experience it at all.
Right.
And, you know, so now it's like, or it's say in the job context, my job is at risk, and, or I might have been wrong about something. So it's not okay to like let on like that's true, or it's not okay. Like, so guys go around pretending they're not feeling anything instead of compartmentalizing it and going home to their wife or going back to their dad or going to their best friend and saying, man, that really hurt. You know, instead they just pretend like, so we got it all twisted.
For sure.
And I think that's, you know, as a guy who wants to do something for men to help men be better and be more sane and not ultimately not swallow a bullet.
Right.
You know, because a lot of times that's what ends up happening from not experiencing your feelings. It all comes out anyway, somehow, always. You know, but that is a lesson, I think, that needs to be taught, that we need to understand that it's not about, we don't need to not have feelings. We need to learn how to have them and manage them. And being a man, it doesn't mean you don't feel. It means that we have this gift as men that I think in a bigger way than women, we're able to compartmentalize things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where I don't think women are as able to do that as men are. At least that's what I've been taught. And that's what I've come to believe. But yeah, so we can say, all right, I'm going to set this fear aside or pain or grief or whatever. Set it aside. I'll get back to that later after I do what I need to do to survive or get through my day or whatever it is. But it doesn't mean we don't talk about it.
Absolutely. And I think that's the piece that's important, you know, is being able to talk about it after the fact. And most importantly, like what you were saying, is be able to identify who is safe for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think that I was just having a conversation with a friend about this, but oftentimes the people that are safe and the people that are unsafe often look very similar on the surface and in initial relationships. And it's really being able to walk a journey of discovery with them to understand, like, are they authentic? Mm-hmm. Are they real? You know, and also know that at some point these people will, you know, there will be some type of transgression or rip in the relationship. You know, we're all human, you know, and so somebody that I love and care about could, you know, share a story that I didn't want them to share, or, you know, not invite me to a movie. And that doesn't mean that they don't like me. That also just means that, like, when there's that emotion, that feeling, in me, you know, about that to what you're saying, don't compartmentalize and put that in, you know, in the deep, dark recesses of our mind, you know, to only punish them later for, but to be able to talk about it and to repair.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know? And another thing that comes to mind just talking about this is the guys who aren't safe are the ones who are going to make fun of the idea of needing to be safe. You know, because that's the other part of this. Like, people make fun of that shit. And so, you know, that brings me to what is safe? What does that actually mean? And maybe as guys, we need to stop using that term. Because what it really means is, do I trust you enough to really let you know who I am? Let you into my internal world. And, you know, like you, Ed, I trust enough to like let you in and feel like I could tell you probably just about anything and have you not judge me, you know, because that's what the protection is from. It's from judgment.
Yeah.
And what needs to exist for that judgment to be absent is for the person to be grounded in the reality of we're all human beings.
Right.
You know, we all make mistakes. We all have feelings. We all, you know, we all have shame. We all do things wrong. I mean, but, you know, what I experience with someone who isn't quote unquote safe, and you know, who looks like the person who could be, but you find out they're not when you talk to them and you tell them something or you ask them a question or, you know, and they give you this look like, and might even say like, I don't even know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
Right.
You know, because what it is that it makes them uncomfortable because, right. You know, if the thing about vulnerability is that, you know, when you're vulnerable with someone who is uncomfortable with their vulnerability, they don't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. So it ultimately boils down to the person being in touch with themselves. Like, because if I tell you I'm uncomfortable and that makes you uncomfortable, that really doesn't make you uncomfortable. It brings up your uncomfortability feelings in you that are already there, you know, then you're not going to want to hear it.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, you might even be combative about it.
Oh, for sure.
That's what happens, you know?
Mm-hmm. One, you know, I think that in an ironic twist, you know, I think the language of safe or unsafe is really around, you know, authenticity.
Yeah, it is.
Like, are you able to be real, honest and authentic?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that also speaks to, you know, all of people's reservations of like, how can you use this against me?
Right.
And fear.
Yeah, because, you know, that kid who showed up at treatment and told those guys about how he drank Listerine. like that was a scary thing to do. But it's the lesson is that I was who I was.
Oh, yeah.
This is who I am. Take it or leave it. That was the position I was taking.
Yeah.
And their response was, we'll take it, you know, and that's how it works. That's the whole point of this podcast, because when we're ourselves, we're accepted.
Well, and what a gift, you know, I mean, what an opportunity. I wish I could tell, you know, the world that like I did that. I was the guy who sat in the meeting with a ball cap so far down over his eyes that all he was staring at was just like the chair in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my message to the group was not, I'm here, take it or leave it. My message to the group was, I don't even want you to know I'm here.
Right. Right.
Like I'm testing this like for safety. And for me, safety is like, is such a primitive place of like, I didn't have covers to pull over my head, but I had a ball cap to pull over my eyes because I was so worried that people were going to see me, you know, and that's the, and thank God I didn't choose to live there.
Yeah. Well, and this, you know, one last point as it relates to all this stuff, it speaks to the irony that, you know, there's this conventional wisdom, general perception that a man who feels and expresses his feelings is weak.
Mm.
You know, that's the unspoken message that we get as boys, like, don't do that. That means you're right. Weak. But in reality, it takes such courage to be real and to talk about how you feel and let people really know who you are. It takes courage. So it's actually the opposite of what we're taught that it is.
100%.
Yeah. Man, I could go on like this forever with you. I love having these conversations with you. So,
oh, I know, me too.
But all right, so we talked about this at the beginning, like you had to give some thought to what you were going to say to this. So you go back to a time in your life when the younger Ed needed support and needed some advice. When was it? And what would you tell him?
Yeah, I think the younger Ed would have been freshman year of high school, where I really got into seeing like relationships on the outside. I looked for validation on the outside to validate how I felt on the inside. And I'd probably tell that younger Ed to work on just validating who I was, to be able to build relationships off of, you know, who I want to be, as opposed to, you know, codependently managing all relationships to be who other people feel like I need to be. You know, and I think it's interesting, you know, it's an interesting perspective or look back. All of that management, image management, blah, blah, blahs, in high school. And I don't talk to one of my high school friends, and I'm using air quotes here, because I don't really think I had any friends in high school. I had people who liked me for the version that I showed them.
Right.
And I'm okay with that, because now I have so many friends that understand me for me. And maybe I'll go back for my, you know, 15, 20 year high school reunion and be able to show them, you know, the man that I'm proud to be, and we'll change some of those relationships.
All right. So, well, love you, Ed. Appreciate it.
I love you, man.
I thank you for doing this.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.